From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It can be difficult to be an LGBTQ teenager, so difficult, in fact, many end up homeless. Up to 40% of the homeless youth in America are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer. In many cases, they're rejected by their families because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. It's a complicated and deeply emotional crisis, and we'll hear about it from those who've lived it. This hour on Point, Young, LGBTQ, and Homeless in America. You can join us on air or online. Is this your story, your family's struggle? Or do you know somebody who's been through it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Sassafras Lowry. She was forced out of her home at 17, a queer writer and activist. Her anthology, Kicked Out, is a collection of essays about homeless LGBTQ teens. Sassafras Lowry, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Jessica, so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. So let's start with your story. Would you take us back to the days when you were a teenager and first sharing your identity with people in your life? Why did you feel alone?
Sure. So I think one of the first things about being a young queer person was very quickly realizing that my identity was going to cost a whole lot for me. And it really meant losing the life that I had known. It meant losing my family and my community, not being safe in my school. But it ended up opening a lot of different doors for me. I learned a whole lot about what community means and what it means to build your own family.
You were advised to reconcile with your family at the time, but you've said since that that was exactly the wrong advice. Can you give us a little bit of the picture of your world at the time and why that was not the right choice for you?
Yeah, so I think a lot of times, both then and now, adults are very good at telling young people what to do, and very good at putting their own ideas and beliefs and experiences onto to young people who really are the experts of their own lives and their own experiences. And for me, being when I was a young person, when I was a teenager, I knew really intimately how dysfunctional and violent and dangerous my family of origin was. And it was very easy for social workers and, you know, guidance counselors to tell me that, you know, that I should reconcile. And what I heard in those messages was, you should go back home so that we don't have to deal with you and we don't have to deal with your people. When in fact, you know, for me to reconcile with my family would have been incredibly dangerous.
And you left your family, you left a shelter home that you also found, and you didn't even find support at school.
Yeah, I grew up in semi-rural Oregon, and at the time, and is still the case for many young people in various places in the country, my school was not cut out to deal with me. They didn't know what to do. They said I was the first homeless youth they'd ever had in that school. And they really were at a loss. Even the most well-meaning people within the school really didn't know what to do.
In fact, you had a lesbian teacher, you write, that you felt wanted to help you, but also felt so constrained that she didn't.
Well, she did in her own way. I think that one of the challenges that LGBT adults faced, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s and continue to face in various communities is the concern that to, you know, step forward and speak out and protect LGBT youth will be frowned upon. And in many communities across the country, it can cost you your job.
We've referenced that you wrote an anthology. You call it Kicked Out. It's your voice and the voices of many others. Would you read from a piece of it, something about your story?
Sure. This is a bit from my story. In every apartment, in every shack turned house, I was searching for an end to the fear. I have a friend who describes her panic attacks as the aftermath of a decomposing star. In some ways, that's the closest I'll ever get to describing the way it feels to unravel in the IKEA showroom, because picking a living room set is an emotional experience bringing forth years of instability, of moving every few months to escape homophobic, transphobic neighbors who chased us out of neighborhood after neighborhood. Once you've lost home, you're never the same. You will spend the rest of your life questioning whether you had it to begin with and if it's ever possible to find it again. I survived because I created family, because I found a pack that would fight for me.
It's beautifully written. You're a great writer, so at least you had that to turn to and express yourself. I'm curious, how did you survive?
Yeah, I was very lucky. I was able to very quickly find my way out of the suburban and my rural community that I was had grown up in, and I made my way to Portland, and I built a family of other youth who were having similar experiences, who were homeless, who were marginally housed, who were couch surfing, and found queer adults who were able to support us and stand behind us, and most importantly, listen to us and let us be the experts on our lives.
Your experience is not unique. There are many people across the country who are going through this. I was hoping you would listen and then react to some stories of other people who are LGBTQ teens who found themselves homeless. The first is Jackson, a transgender teen who described his experience after being kicked out of his home. And this was gathered by a center in New York City called the Ali Forney Center, which is an organization for LGBTQ homeless youth. Here is Jackson.
Sleeping here at the ferry where there was absolutely nobody that I knew in a city by myself, and I'm sleeping outside, was extremely heartbreaking, and I felt empty. Like, there was nothing that could fill that void that I felt inside of me from, you know, being away from my family, even though they didn't accept me, it's still, you know, my family.
And this one is from Ryan, a homeless female-born transgender youth who was kicked out of home after coming out to his mom.
I'd come out to my mom when I was 15. That started things to be really, really rocky between my mom and I. Immediately after, I told her that, you know, I wanted to start transitioning, I wanted to start living as male full time. Her exact reaction was, "You can do that, you just can't live here." And that was my introduction to the streets.
You know, I was surprised to read Sassafras. According to a Pew poll, only 56% of LGBTQ adults say they've told their mother about their sexual orientation or gender identity. Only 39% have told their father. So it's a much more harrowing experience for people, I think, than a lot of culture leads us to believe right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about the stories we just heard and whether you've heard other stories like this? I mean, these people were living on the streets.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the most, you know, important things to really think about with LGBTQ youth homelessness is that it truly is an epidemic that impacts youth in communities across the country and in every community. And so, you know, these stories that we just heard are, you know, absolutely representative of the experiences of young people across the country right now, today. And, you know, are very reminiscent of many of the stories that I heard from current and former homeless LGBTQ youth when I was editing the Kicked Out anthology.
Why aren't they going to foster homes, you know, using the Department of Children and Family Services to find support?
For a variety of reasons, you know, and some youth are. For many, many LGBTQ youth, the homes that they're running away from or the homes that they're being kicked out from have been dysfunctional for a long time. They may have already had interactions, you know, with the foster care system. Some cities and communities have better and more supportive systems. But for many young people, those systems designed, you know, in theory to protect them and offer them shelter and safety are as homophobic and transphobic and violent as the families that they have run away from or been kicked out of, if not more so.
So some of these kids do leave their biological parents, go into foster care, and find the same problems there.
Absolutely. A significant number of young people across the country are, you know, abused and within the foster care system because of their sexual orientation and gender identity. For a large number of young people, those systems are not safe for them either.
And when you were going through this yourself, did you find that there were any resources out there that you could take advantage of?
When I was a teenager, my primary goal was to stay out of foster care and systems because I knew really clearly that those systems were not going to help me. I had a victim's advocate from the courts. There were legal proceedings happening against my mother when I was 17 because of abuse in the home. And the victim's advocate, who had seen the bruises, had, you know, heard all of the testimonies in court, and her advice to me was, you really should go home because it sounds like, you know, your mother loves you. And I was like, really? And that was the biggest inclination to me, that these people had no idea what they were talking about. Obviously, there are amazing people working within, you know, foster care systems that are doing good work. But all too often, there are workers who have no idea how to handle LGBTQ youth.
And I read you compare it to domestic violence. No one would tell the victim of domestic violence to go back to their abuser.
Exactly. Exactly.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the strikingly large number of LGBTQ youth who are homeless in America. You can join this conversation. With growing acceptance, why are some young LGBTQ people falling through the cracks? What's the right role for families, for schools, and the government? And we're speaking now with Sassafras Lowry, an activist and former LGBTQ homeless youth, who's coming back. And joining us now also from Washington is Gregory Lewis. He's executive director of the True Colors Fund, a national organization supporting LGBTQ homeless youth. Gregory Lewis, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jessica. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Gregory, we heard about Sassafras' story when she came out and became homeless or without a family in her teenage years. She's not alone. You work with these teenagers. Give us a sense how big this population is.
Well, yes, we do. And Sassafras is a perfect example of what a young person can become when they really work hard to overcome the obstacles of homelessness. So for the scope of homelessness as it pertains to LGBT homeless youth, the overall homeless youth population is around 1.6 million youth in this country each year, and about 500,000 of them are homeless for more than a week. So if you take the 40% number, you can get those numbers pretty clearly. So it's a huge overarching problem, not just for LGBT youth, but for all homeless youth.
You know, it's somewhat surprising because it would seem that acceptance of LGBTQ issues has grown. But is it your sense that pop culture and even news coverage is misleading about the degree of acceptance?
It's kind of a catch-22 because we're kind of victims of our own success. While we need to be celebrating our advances for LGBT equality, at the same time, it has resulted in young people coming out at younger ages. So right now, the average age that a young person comes out is 13 years old, and about 10 years ago it was 19. So you're seeing a massive influx of young people, particularly transgender young people, who are coming out much younger and coming out in communities and in environments in their homes that are still not accepting. So while the greater society is, unfortunately, they're still stuck in environments that are not.
I just want to underscore something you just said. You said especially transgender young people. Is it a particular problem for transgender kids?
it's a growing problem for transgender kids, and particularly from our own study that we do with homeless youth providers every 2 years. When we asked 400 homeless youth providers how many of them work with transgender youth, over the last 10 years, it went from 40% of them working with transgender youth to 80%.
And do you think that's more, sorry, but is that because more people are identifying early as transgender?
Yeah.
Or because, okay.
It is, and it's the same. It's kind of following the same thing that happened with lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth, who understood what sexual orientation was. Society had a greater acceptance of sexual orientation, and they were able to come to kind of terms with it at a younger age. And that happened, you know, definitely in the 90s and the early 2000s. And now you have transgender youth going through the same process, where you're now seeing more positive portrayals of transgender people in society. And people that young transgender people can look up to and understand that that is who they are as well.
I'd like to go to the phones now. Tim is calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, with a comment. Hi, Tim. What's on your mind?
Hello, Jessica and guests. Basically, it sounds like these children are falling through the cracks. And to me, I think that the parents should have to pay for these children until they're 18, whether that be through paying for an apartment or paying for child care or something, you know, basically child support, very similar to spousal support, or they should be thrown in jail for child neglect and abandonment.
Tim, thanks for the call. Gregory, I heard Sassafras say earlier that the government failed her too, but technically, legally, these parents still should be on the hook to at least help support their kids, correct?
Well, you also have to think that homeless youth are not just up to 18. Really, we look at homeless unaccompanied youth from 12 to 24 in this country. So that kind of gets lost in the conversation as well. So there is a huge portion of that population that is 18 to 24 years old. So particularly for them, we need to make sure that there's resources that they can access and get support from. You know, adult shelters, adult systems are not appropriate for young people 18 to 24. And we need to make sure that we're providing services that are appropriate and safe and welcoming for them, and also understand that these are still young people developing and needing that kind of support as they're coming to terms with who they are as adults and moving on into, you know, into their adulthood.
Sassafras, in your experience dealing with people who have been homeless, have they found the courts a useful resource, helpful? Do they understand, family court, understand what these kids are going through?
You know, I think that, you know, there's always, you know, there's exceptions where systems work the way that they're, you know, in theory designed to do, and that they support young people. So those stories absolutely exist. But, you know, certainly in my own experience and, you know, through the course of editing Kicked Out and talking to numerous formerly homeless youth throughout the country, you know, very, very seldom do those court systems end up being supportive places for young people.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us also from San Francisco is Caitlin Ryan. She's a clinical social worker and director of the Family Acceptance Project for LGBTQ youth and their families. Caitlin Ryan, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hello, Jessica.
Hi.
And guests.
Thanks for being with us. You know, you are dealing with this crisis in your office on a day-to-day basis. Would you tell us what's coming through your door? What is true of the families you're talking to?
Well, we've both studied and worked in family intervention work with a wide range of families from diverse ethnic backgrounds, social backgrounds, religious backgrounds, families that are accepting, ambivalent, and rejecting of their LGBT children. And we've documented specific behaviors that they use to reject or accept their children, and then have linked all of those accepting and rejecting behaviors with health and well-being for their LGBT children. So we've developed a new framework, if you will, a new language to help them understand the consequences of their actions. And we've been very successful in helping increase support and decrease rejection for a lot of families that historically would have started out as rejecting of that LGBT child.
Caitlin, stand by for a moment. We want to bring in Ken, who's calling on the phone from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Ken. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. Speaking as someone who had a gay male at the age of 16 in my household, It wasn't just that he was a gay male. It was the fact that the attitude behind it and him forcing that lifestyle on me, which and I didn't accept it. So he was 16, and until you are 18 and out of the house, it is my house where I pay the bills, and your job is to go to school and learn. Now, you can that lifestyle, you can live it all you want to when you're outside of my household, but when you're in my household, you abide by my rules.
Ken, thank you for the call and for your forthrightness. Caitlin, let me ask this of you. I imagine you hear this often. What would you counsel a family in this situation?
Well, one of the challenges in counseling families is really educating them. We've found that across all kinds of backgrounds, whether they've had extensive education or have never really learned to read or write, many of them have profound misinformation and disinformation about sexual orientation and gender identity, especially in children and adolescents. So a large part of our work is culturally appropriate education for them, guiding them, helping them understand what this means, and helping them understand that the way they respond to their LGBT children has a powerful effect on that child's health and well-being, including some family rejecting behaviors that we've identified have a more than 9 times greater likelihood of attempted suicide, as well as high risk for HIV and substance abuse. And of course, all of this contributes to conflict and the likelihood of ending up out of home.
But Caitlin, have you found a way to persuade or talk to parents who don't share their kids' values, but teach them to embrace the child as somebody they love, even if they have different worldviews?
We have, and it has to do, Jessica, with starting where the family is, starting where their level of education and understanding really is, identifying what their underlying cultural and religious values are, and then really building on that to help them understand that there are consequences to the way they're responding to that LGBT adolescent. And one of the powerful, I think, things that we've learned in our work is that many families have no idea that how they're responding to their LGBT child has such negative outcomes, not only for that young person, but also for the whole family. So not only are we teaching them a new way of thinking, but we're also helping them modify these behaviors that are putting that LGBT adolescent at risk and helping them understand that being supportive, supporting that LGBT adolescent does not necessarily mean accepting a behavior or what they might call a lifestyle that they disagree with.
Let's get in a different point of view. Ian is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Ian.
Hi, Jessica. I just want to say that I am a parent, and I believe, because no child ever asks to be born. As a parent, your job is to love your child, regardless of who your child is. Am I wrong? I think if no child wants to be born, they don't ask that. Our job as parents is to love our kid. Simple.
Thank you, Ian. It's a compassionate call. I appreciate it. Preston also now calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was calling to just leave a quick comment about the family piece. My boyfriend, when he was coming out, his family kind of reacted in the way that I think a lot of families in the South or in very conservative families do. And they initially came around and have become very accepting. And now when we talk about it, we've learned that for them it was coming from a place of love. And for them it was a way for them to protect my boyfriend from a life that they thought was going to send him to down a very dangerous path. And so I think that dialogue oftentimes doesn't happen. We think of families that reject their children as being villains and full of hate. And I think that there can be a lot of focus placed on the reasoning behind it as one from a place of protection in their own minds, and how do we kind of focus on that and bring people to the mindset that you can actually help protect your child, and by rejecting them, you're going to potentially cause some really harmful behaviors and you know, confusion in their life. And so I think this dialogue around how we can reconcile families with youth is fantastic, and we need to do a lot more of that.
Preston, thank you for the call. Gregory Lewis, let me ask you. Gregory Lewis runs a national organization focused on gay and transgender youth homelessness. there's a lot. There are a lot of comments about parents and what motivates them to do this. That earlier caller who asked, "What would ever cause a parent to kick a child out of the home?" What have you discovered in your interactions with families is going on in their minds?
You know, I think something that Caitlin said is so important. It's a matter of meeting parents where they're at. And really understanding who they are and where they're at. And also the last caller hit it right on the head as well in saying that we have to stop thinking of parents as the villain and as the enemy. If we're ever really going to, you know, help repair those bonds, if we kind of let this, you know, systemic, you know, story of parents being the enemy continue to, you know, be out there, we're never going to really help get these kids back with their families when it is safe and appropriate.
So what's the better response? You're saying don't vilify sure. them, work with them?
Yes, work with them. And one of the things that we're doing is in partnership with the federal government, we have launched the very first initiative, community-based initiative in Cincinnati and Houston to look at how we can actually prevent LGBT youth from becoming homeless. And it's an initiative that was built from the ground up in both communities, really bringing everybody together from the runaway and homeless youth system to child welfare to juvenile justice, to the schools, to everybody that we could bring together that could address this issue together to really build a community-based plan to really look at how we can prevent LGBT youth from becoming homeless. Obviously, addressing the family issue for sure, but there's many other issues that are causing LGBT youth to become homeless. Everything from poverty to, you know, the foster aging out of the foster care system to abuse in the home that may not even be directed to them based on their sexual orientation and gender identity. So
Can I just ask you a question to clarify this on the family piece? Are there cases in which the family is so rejecting that they kick the child out of the home, but at the same time are willing to come in for counseling?
There are situations, yes, that we've talked to agencies around this country that do engage in family therapy where that does happen. It takes some more work and in-depth partnership between, you know, an agency and a family and the young person to engage in. And, you know, that's work that Caitlin's doing as well as many agencies across the country. We need a lot more of it, and it needs to be studied more and piloted and tested more, but it is being done.
Sassafras, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation. Sassafras Lowry was an LGBTQ homeless youth and is now an LGBTQ activist. What are you thinking about this? Because I understand that you don't think reconciliation with the parents is necessarily the right first step.
No, you know, I think that for some young people, that is the answer. And it goes back to, I'm much more interested in meeting young people where they're at. And if that's a process that feels safe and affirming for them, that's the process that should be taken on. But at the end of the day, you know, I say, you know, it's a nice idea to say that parents aren't the enemy. However, for the vast majority of LGBTQ young people in this country, parents are the villains in this story. And we don't suggest that, you know, victims of domestic violence reconcile with their abusers. And so I think it's dangerous and outrageous that we are in some ways suggesting that LGBTQ youth should be pushed towards reconciliation. You know, I think the thing that we all agree on is that family is really important. Where we disagree is what family should be prioritized. And I really think that the most important thing is to encourage LGBTQ youth to build their own families, their own supportive chosen families, and then at whatever later point, they can make their own decision about reconciliation.
Caitlin Ryan, clinical social worker, can you give us a very quick answer? We're coming up on a break. Is family reconciliation a solution, but not necessarily the solution?
Person can reconnect with their family. I think the issue is permanency. It may mean finding a family member who could learn to become more supportive, but it certainly involves finding other adults who can provide permanency in their life.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the 40% of American homeless youth who are LGBTQ. You can join our conversation how can we get the at-risk LGBTQ youth off the streets and to safety? And do you know any at-risk kids? I want to bring in some more voices now of some of the people facing the crisis of homelessness, coming out, and acceptance. This is Derek, a homeless youth, describing his experience.
After my parents were abusing me, I left the house to move with my aunt. I lived with my aunt for like 4 days. My aunt used to tell me who sleeps with a man as he would with a woman was a sin. And I told my aunt, I sleep with a man as I would with a man and a woman as I would with a woman. And afterwards, I left the house. The worst thing about being homeless in a situation like this is knowing that you have a family, but your family won't help you.
And here's the perspective of a parent in an interview on KCRW's To The Point in September. Wendy Montgomery, an outspoken advocate for gay youth within the Mormon Church, said that 2 months after she found out her 13-year-old son was gay were among the darkest days of her life, and that at first she turned to the Mormon Church for answers.
It made me feel much worse about our situation. It made me feel like I had to choose between my child and my church. But there has never even been one moment when we hesitated in accepting him, and our love and support for him never wavered. But I felt like I would have to give up my faith that was so much a part of me that I loved and believed in deeply, and this felt devastating to me.
We'll get to the religious conflict and all of this. But first, I want to bring back in our guests. Sassafras Lowry, her book is Kicked Out, an anthology of true stories from current and former LGBTQ homeless youth. Also with us, Gregory Lewis from the True Colors Fund, fighting to end LGBTQ homelessness. And Caitlin Ryan of the Family Acceptance Project. Caitlin, I want to go back to you because you were talking before the break about family reunification and the priorities for kids who find themselves on their own.
I think part of the challenge is that we're thinking so much after the fact, and what we really have to think about, Jessica, is prevention, early intervention, going upstream to provide education and guidance to family when children are very little. In our research and family intervention work, we've found that because of widespread access to information, children are coming out as gay at 7, 9, 10, 11, and families see gender-diverse children at very early ages. And we have to help them understand how to support these LGBT children really before they understand what their child's sexual orientation and gender identity is, as well as, of course, putting services and supports in place to address family conflict and help care for LGBT young people when they end up out of home.
You know, there's another issue that came up in the remarks by the Mormon parent, and that was the role of religion in all of this. Allie Forney, who runs one of the largest centers for LGBTQ homeless youth, put a full-page ad in the New York Times on Palm Sunday calling on Pope Francis to make the Catholic Church more accepting more helpful to homeless gay kids. He said, quote, "I'm calling on you to take urgent action to protect them from the devastating consequences of religious rejection, which is the most common reason LGBTQ teens are driven from their homes." Gregory Lewis, you run an organization for homeless youth. Is religion the leading reason, a reason, a factor in homelessness for this population?
It's definitely one of the key factors to families rejecting their kids, no doubt.
And what have you found in dealing with these kids? If they ask their parents to go back to their religious institution, do they ever actually find useful support there?
There are many religions across the country and denominations that are very affirming of LGBT people, and we need to encourage and work with the religious communities to grow that trend. You know, for instance, we just announced a big partnership with Covenant House International, the largest provider of homeless youth services in the country, to really improve their response to working with LGBT homeless youth, you know, a religious-based, largest provider of homeless youth services in this country. It's possible, and we can meet people where they're at and really work with people who of religious faith to understand the importance of accepting and welcoming their kids and when they come out.
You know, I want to correct something I said earlier. The man who published the op-ed or the letter in the New York Times is Carl Siciliano. He's the director of the Ali Forney Center in New York. Let's go to the phones for a moment. This is Michelle calling from Germantown, Maryland. Michelle, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. Yes, I just recently launched a nonprofit called Honorary Nieces and Nephews, Inc., and we're going to be awarding scholarships, need-based and educational scholarships for LGBTQ homeless and foster care youth who have aged out of the system. I launched this because I personally had been homeless when I was young and have been in the foster care system. So this is another area where youth are being thrown out as well through the foster care system when the foster care parents don't want LGBTQ youth, and then if they don't feel wanted, sometimes they emancipate themselves.
Great. I want to give you a chance to do a shout out. Your organization, again, is called Honorary Nieces and Nephews for People Kicked Out of the Foster Care System. What's your website?
Well, it's for the youth that have aged out of the foster care
aged system.
And LGBTQ homeless youth.
Okay, great. Honorary Nieces and Nephews Incorporated. Thank you, Michelle, for the call. And Michael is on the phone from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Jessica. Wonderful topic. I felt a little bit like the parents are being attacked here, or being not supported for their kids, and I wanted to call in and kind of bring up the story of happened in our own life. My son is gay. He came out in the early years of high school. He went to a very rural high school in an area where, unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of this and a lot of coming out, a lot of kids coming out. But he made a decision to do this, and we, as parents, you know, we tried to be supportive. We said, you know, you realize that this is going to make your life at school very difficult. And we went through counseling and everything else, but what I wanted to bring up is his choice to, or his, you know, his coming out and saying that he was gay and telling us that he was gay, and we tried to be supportive of that in our home. But at 16, he moved out. At 16 and 17 years age, and it had nothing to do with us not being supportive, but his lifestyle choice, or his choice to be gay, was such that he decided that he should be able to have his boyfriend stay over. His boyfriend could hang around. His boyfriend could be there whenever he wanted to. And we said, you know what, this is not okay. It's not okay for your younger sister, and it wasn't okay for her when she got to be his age. And he couldn't live by those rules, and because we had those rules on him and his sister, and said, no, you have rules in this house you have to follow. He said that we weren't being supportive of him being gay.
You're saying it's a parenting conflict as opposed to homophobia, for example. I'm curious, if you can answer briefly, do you have a relationship with your son now?
He bounced around between friends for a while. We tried to encourage him to come back home. He refused to follow the rules. If he did, we do. Yes, we're 4 years beyond that now. And yes, thankfully, you know, we never lost touch with our son, and he is back in our lives again, thank God. But, you know, he still to this day says that we had this turmoil because we weren't supportive of his lifestyle. And that had nothing to do with it.
Thank you, Michael, for the call and for bringing us a fuller picture of one type of experience. Caitlin Ryan runs the Family Acceptance Project in San Francisco. I'm curious. I've read that a good percentage of homeless LGBTQ youth say that they left not because they were kicked out, but because they've chosen to seek independence. And that's what I sort of heard in that call just then. Is it, though, of a piece? Is it because they're feeling a lack of support from the parents, or they need to express this part of their identity in a different space?
I think there are many dynamics that are going on in these families, Jessica, and we can't really parse them all out in a few minutes. What we've found is in our research is that we identified over 100 specific accepting and rejecting behaviors that parents and caregivers use to respond to their LGBT children. And across the U.S. and in many other countries, we found that many parents and caregivers thought they were accepting when, in fact, they were tolerant at best. And part of what we're doing in different languages and from different faith traditions is teaching parents, families, foster parents, caregivers how to support their LGBT children. And that includes helping families that think they're accepting really learn what acceptance really means, and helping those that are struggling begin to decrease those rejecting behaviors and stop them so that they can actually increase the connectedness with their child and protect their child from harm.
Gregory Lewis works with homeless youth, and you're in Washington, D.C. I'm curious what kind of resources are available to you. And let me make that broader. Is this an issue that policymakers in Washington are beginning to focus in on?
They need to focus in on it more. And basically, you know, right now, for instance, in Congress, we are working to reauthorize the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, which is the only piece of federal legislation that actually specifically provides programming for runaway and homeless youth in this country. It provides about, currently the funding level is about $116 million to fund street outreach programs, basic shelter, and transitional living programs across the country. It's only a drop in the bucket. When you consider that in any given night, when the country does a point in time count every single year, which is doesn't nearly catch as many homeless youth as we need it to, because youth are much harder to count. But in any given night this year, about 45,000 young people were homeless, unaccompanied homeless youth. And the federal government provides about 4,200 beds. So they're not even meeting 10% of the need of a low count of youth that are actually needing services. So right now, we're working very hard to reauthorize the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act so that we can ensure increased services and we can make some really important improvements, such as ensuring that young people can actually identify the adults in their lives that they deem as family. So we have to, Sassafras kind of talked about this, is allowing young people to identify those people they trust in their lives and allow homeless youth programs that are working with them to work with those adults along with the young person to really help move them on to success and happy futures. Because there are many instances where a young person can't reconnect with their, you know, immediate nuclear family.
But there's someone else to connect to.
Absolutely.
Pause for a moment if you are willed. I'd like to bring in Lydie, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Lydie. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. I just wanted to say, so I am also a social worker, and I used to work at Youth on Fire, which is a drop-in center for homeless youth. And I'm really glad this conversation is starting to take a turn away from the parents, because I think it's really important to talk about, once a youth is homeless, LGBT youth experience a significant amount of discrimination within the system. And I think that we really need to talk about, as you said, you know, not all youth are able to reconnect with their families, and we really need to talk about our systems and make sure that they're supportive in a way that is going to help them succeed. Because what happens is LGBT youth experience a really significant amount of violence at a higher rate, and it becomes harder to get out of homeless once they're there.
Okay. So I think that's— Lydie, thank you for the call. Sassafras, I wonder if you'd react to that. Violence is a reality that a lot of homeless LGBT youth have to face.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that the caller is right on point that, you know, the real conversation that we need to be having is what are the resources and the experiences of young people who are on the streets, who are homeless or marginally housed or couch surfing. And for many of those young people, they do experience, you know, very high rates of violence. And those are conversations. How do we make systems safer for young people, increase shelter beds, increase the amount of support that youth have when they do end up on their own?
You know, I want to ask Caitlin with the Family Acceptance Project. One change is kids are starting to identify as not, we talked about transgender, but also about gay, lesbian, bisexual earlier and come out earlier, I guess. Is that part of the reason we're seeing this homelessness epidemic now?
Well, actually, Jessica, if you go back to the late 1980s, reports from community agencies and publications documented a 25% to 40% estimates of homeless youth were LGBT. So this is a longstanding problem that has existed for a long time. It's only more recently that the public has become aware of LGBT youth. For years, they were invisible. I think the early age is certainly driving it, but there is a greater interest in these issues, and advocates have been pressing for this. Gregory and other groups have really been pressing to bring this to the forefront. And it's such a serious problem, but it requires a range from prevention to early intervention to putting beds in place to many. It's very complex, and there's not a single answer.
Would you expand on what schools can do?
Well, one of the things that schools can do is to help educate parents and families and start by educating teachers, school-based providers, all of the educators and administrators in all of the schools, public and private. And part of the challenge is that while they've addressed discrimination and harassment in the school in a policy way, they really need to address this in a more substantive way by making sure that every school-based provider understands to how to identify young people who may be struggling with these issues at early ages. And part of the challenge, I think, is that many people think of LGBT youth as 15 or 16, but what we're really talking about are young people that are struggling with these issues in childhood, and really very few schools are beginning to address these issues in elementary school.
Sassafras, can I ask you to just wrap us up with whatever words you would want to give to LGBTQ kids out there who are thinking of coming out and facing this dilemma?
And the biggest message that I have for LGBTQ youth, you know, whether they're coming out or are currently homeless, is that they're not alone and that there is a whole community out there waiting for them and ready to listen to their stories.
Sassafras Lowry, thank you so much. Editor of Kicked Out, Gregory Lewis, Executive Director of the True Colors Fund, and Caitlin Ryan of the Family Acceptance Project. Thank you to all of you for your work and for your time today. And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.